Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a figure who looms incredibly large in art history, maybe larger than his actual lifespan would suggest. Tommaso di Ser Giovanni di Simone.
Or as we know him, Masaccio. A name that really means revolution in paint.
Exactly, and that's our mission today, figuring out how this artist, Masaccio, who died at just 26, managed to completely redirect Western painting during the Italian Quattrocento, the 15th century.
It's genuinely astonishing, 26 years old.
Right, I mean, today that's barely getting started, but he basically dismantled centuries of style and invented a new way of seeing, all based on, well, reality and math.
He's widely seen as the first truly great painter of the Quattrocento.
Right.
And our understanding comes a lot from Giorgio Vasari, you know, the great biographer of Renaissance artists.
Mm.
Vasari praised him specifically for imitating nature like nobody else at the time. He wasn't just telling stories visually, he was recreating life.
How so? What did Vasari see?
Believable figures, lifelike movement, real psychological depth, and crucially, a convincing sense of three-dimensionality. He brought back a way of showing space and volume that hadn't really been mastered since, well, ancient Rome. Things like solid nudes, real weight, complex foreshortening.
Okay, but here's the kicker, the thing that always gets me. His name, Masaccio. It means clumsy Tom or messy Tom, something like that.
Yeah, it's quite the name. Apparently, to distinguish him from his collaborator, Masolino, who was little Tom.
So how on earth does clumsy Tom, name suggesting, you know, maybe he wasn't the most meticulous guy, become the father of this incredibly rigorous, mathematically precise Renaissance style? That's the puzzle, isn't it?
It really is. And that contrast kind of sums up the whole artistic moment in Florence. Masolino, the older guy, he represented the established style, the international Gothic, graceful, delicate, maybe a bit flat.
Beautiful, but maybe not. Solid.
Exactly. Whereas Masaccio stood for the future. Solid, weighty, realistic. He cared more about the sheer physical presence, the volume of a figure, than just elegant lines on the surface.
So our deep dive today is going to unpack those specific breakthroughs. We're talking linear perspective, foreshortening, and that amazing use of light and shadow, chiaroscuro.
Right. Understanding how these techniques, crammed into such a short career, had this immediate, profound impact. An impact you see directly in later giants. People like Leonardo, Michelangelo, they all studied him.
Okay, let's get into the man himself. Tommaso di Ser Giovanni di Simone Cassai, born December 21st, 1401, in Castel San Giovanni di Altura Modern San Giovanni Valdarno in Tuscany.
And the family name Cassai tells us something. It likely comes from his grandfather's trade. They were Cassai, carpenters, or maybe cabinet makers.
Interesting. So maybe an early exposure to craft, to structure?
Possibly. But his early life wasn't stable. His father was a notary, Ser Giovanni, but he died in 1406. Masaccio was only 5.
Oh.
His mother remarried soon after. And interestingly, his younger brother, Giovanni, born that same year, 1406, also became a painter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, known as Lo Scheggia.
Lo Scheggia, what does that mean?
The splinter.
Huh. So we have clumsy Tom and the splinter. Quite the pair.
Florentine nicknames, you gotta love them.
But this brings us to a big gap in the story. His training. How did he learn to paint? Normally, there'd be an apprenticeship, right? Starting young, moving to Florence, maybe?
You'd expect that.
Yeah.
But the records, even Vasari, they're completely silent on his formal artistic education. We just don't know who his master was. It's a bit of a mystery.
So, speculation.
Lots of it. Maybe he started illuminating manuscripts, trained locally before Florence. Vasari later suggested Masolino was his teacher. But honestly, their styles are so different, especially early on.
Masaccio seems so much more radical right from the start.
Exactly. It makes a formal apprenticeship under Masolino seem, well, unlikely. What we do know for sure is when he officially arrives on the scene.
Yeah.
January 7th, 1422. He joined the Painters Guild in Florence, the Arti de' Medici e Speciali.
And that's significant because...
because he joined as an independent master, not an apprentice, not a journeyman, a master. That means by age 20, he was already considered fully proficient, ready to take his own commissions.
Okay, so he bursts onto the scene in 1422. What kind of Florence does he find? What was the Quattrocento environment like?
Oh, it was electric. Florence in the early 15th century wasn't just a city. It was, as you said, a cultural pressure cooker. It was the heart of the early Renaissance.
Driven by humanism.
Absolutely. Humanist scholars were digging up classical texts, Greek and Roman philosophy, art, architecture. There was this huge intellectual shift happening, focusing on reason, clarity, observation, and on, well, man as the center of things.
And the money was there to support it.
Definitely. Florence was wealthy. Powerful patrons, like the Medici family later on, were commissioning art that reflected this new worldview. They wanted art that felt rational, ordered, naturalistic.
So artists weren't just asked to make pretty pictures. They needed to create something that felt true, scientifically plausible.
Precisely. The goal was to depict space convincingly, to render the human figure with anatomical accuracy, to tell stories clearly, using forms that felt mathematically sound and based on how things actually look.
And Masaccio plugs right into this. He finds the right people.
He connects with the absolute key figures who were driving this change.
Like who?
Two stand out immediately. First, Filippo Brunelleschi, the architect.
The Don guy.
The Don guy, yes. But also the inventor, or maybe rediscoverer, of systematic linear perspective. He figured out the geometry, the mathematical rules for showing depth on a flat surface. He basically gave painters like Masaccio a blueprint for creating rational, measurable space.
Okay, so Brunelleschi provides the math, the structure. Who else?
The sculptor Donatello. Donatello was already creating these incredibly powerful, realistic sculptures inspired by classical Roman art. They had weight, volume, real human emotion.
So Donatello gave him the model for the figure.
You could say that. Donatello's work showed Masaccio how to make figures feel solid, weighty, truly present what art historians call plasticity. It was move away from the elegant but kind of ethereal figures of the older Gothic style.
Got it. So Masaccio is like the meeting point. He takes Giotto's earlier steps towards solid figures, adds Donatello's classical weight and psychology, and then fuses it all together using Brunelleschi's new mathematical perspective.
That's a great way to put it. His goal was pretty radical for the time. Ditch the decorative kind of floaty international Gothic style, think Gentile da Fabriano, and create something grounded, naturalistic, using perspective and light in a whole new way.
And maybe that's why he was Clumsy Tom. Maybe he just didn't care about the fussy details because he was so focused on this massive revolutionary project.
That's Vasari's implication, essentially. He wrote that Masaccio was so absorbed in his art, he neglected everything else, his clothes, his gets, social niceties. He was clumsy or absent-minded because his mind was entirely on reinventing painting, not on the delicate refinements of the old style or everyday life.
So we see this shift almost immediately after he joins the guild in 1422. Let's talk about his first known documented work, the San Giovanni Triptych, also dated 1422.
Yes. This piece is incredibly important, partly because it was lost for centuries, only rediscovered in 1961, tucked away in a small church near his hometown.
Wow. And even though it's a traditional format, a triptych, you can already see his new approach.
Absolutely. Even with some surface damage, abrasion over time, his intention is clear. He's already moving away from the norm. Look at the figures.
What about them?
They have volume, actual mass, even in these relatively small panels. And check out their feet. Often a tricky spot for artists struggling with depth.
Right.
Masaccio uses foreshortening convincingly. The saint's feet are planted firmly on the ground. They feel like they're standing in a space, not just floating against a gold background.
And the Virgin's throne, I remember that being different too.
Very different. It's not the usual elaborate, decorative, almost flat Gothic throne. It's simple, blocky, architectural. It looks like a real solid object occupying three-dimensional space. It's a deliberate rejection of the old style, and you can see him looking back to Giotto, but pushing much further.
Okay, so that's 1422. Then comes the collaboration that really highlights the changing of the guard, the Virgin and Child with St. Anne from around 1424. He worked on this with Masolino.
Yes, and this panel is like a textbook comparison of the old and the new. Masolino was older, very established, respected. Masaccio was the young upstart, possibly working under him here.
But you can tell who painted what.
Oh, instantly. The division of hands is incredibly clear. It's so stark. It suggests Masaccio wasn't just, you know, filling in backgrounds. He was painting his own vision right alongside the master.
So who did what?
Masolino painted St. Anne, the grandmother figure behind the Virgin, and the angels flanking them. And they're typical Masolino, delicate, graceful, elegant lines.
The established style.
Exactly. Very refined, almost ethereal. They have that international Gothic grace.
Yeah.
But then look at the main figures, the Virgin Mary and the Christ Child. Those are mazzaccios.
And they're different how?
Totally different feel. They're solid, anchored. They have real physical weight. The Virgin isn't a fragile queen. She feels like a substantial, real woman. Look at her lap, the way the drapery creates this solid, volumetric form for the child to sit on. It's powerful.
It's like sculpture versus drawing, almost. Masaccio's figures feel like they take up space, cast shadows. Masolino's are more like beautiful pattern.
Precisely. It's two different artistic worlds colliding on one panel. A snapshot of the Renaissance transition.
And this is happening around the time Vasari says Masaccio took a very important trip.
Yes. Vasari claims Masaccio went to Rome with Masolino, probably around 1423.
Why was Rome so important for an artist trying to forge this new style?
Because Rome was where you saw the real deal. Actual ancient Roman sculpture, reliefs, architecture. For someone like Masaccio trying to recapture that classical sense of form and realism, seeing those originals would have been mind-blowing.
So Vasari thought this trip kind of sealed the deal, made him fully commit to the classical approach.
That's the idea. Vasari believed it helped Masaccio completely shed any lingering Gothic or Byzantine habits. After Rome, he could fully embrace the naturalism, the anatomy, the monumentality that we see in his mature works, like the Pisa altarpiece figures.
It cemented the direction he was already heading. Now, before we get to the really big commissions, there's a lost work we should mention, the Sagra.
Ah, yes, the Sagra, a huge loss. This was a massive fresco painted around 1422, celebrating the consecration ceremony as Santa Maria del Carmine, the very church where he'd later paint the Brancacci Chapel.
What did it show?
It depicted a procession of contemporary Florentines, important citizens, maybe artists like Brunelleschi and Donatello entering the church. It was apparently groundbreaking in its realistic portraiture and its handling of figures in space.
How do we know about it if it's gone?
Mainly through descriptions and drawings made by later artists who studied it. Famously, even Michelangelo made drawings of figures in the Sagra. That tells you how important it was considered.
But it was destroyed.
Yes, sadly. Destroyed when the cloister it was in was rebuilt probably in the late 16th century. It's frustrating because it sounds like it was a major step and it's just gone. A reminder of how fragile this legacy is.
Okay, now we arrive at the main event. The commission that defines Masaccio started probably around 1425. He and Masolino are hired by Felice Brancacci, a wealthy silk merchant and diplomat.
A very prominent figure in Florence at the time.
To decorate his family chapel in Santa Maria del Carmine. The Brancacci Chapel. This is where Masaccio really lays down the foundations for Renaissance painting, right?
This is ground zero. The frescoes here are just revolutionary. The main cycle shows scenes from the life of St. Peter being the founder of the church, a key figure.
But it starts with Adam and Eve.
Right. Flanking the entrance arch, you have the temptation, likely mostly by Masolino, and then Masaccio's incredibly powerful expulsion from the Garden of Eden. These set the stage for the whole salvation story.
And stylistically, this is where he brings everything together. Giotto's solidity, Donatello's realism, Brunelleschi's perspective.
Exactly. He takes Giotto's sense of monumental, emotionally resonant figures, but elevates it with techniques Giotto didn't have or hadn't fully developed. Consistent linear perspective, yes, but also atmospheric perspective, making distant things look hazier. And crucially, unified directional light.
Which leads to chiaroscuro. Let's unpack that a bit. What exactly is it and why was it such a big deal?
Chiaroscuro literally means light dark in Italian. It's the use of strong contrasts between light and shadow to model forms, to make them look three-dimensional and solid on a flat wall.
How was light typically used before Masaccio?
Often. It was very even, almost symbolic, like a divine light illuminating everything equally without casting consistent, realistic shadows from a single source. Or sometimes light was used just to pick out details decoratively.
But Masaccio makes it behave like real light.
Precisely. He introduces a single, consistent light source within the painting. Sometimes it even mimics the actual light coming from a real window in the chapel itself. This unified light creates logical shadows. And those shadows carve out the figures, giving them incredible volume and presence. They feel like they occupy real space under real lighting conditions.
It makes the scene feel immediate, observable, almost scientific in its approach to light.
It is. It's based on observing the natural world. It makes the painted world operate under the same physical laws as our world. That's a huge philosophical shift right there.
Let's look at specifics. The expulsion from the Garden of Eden. What makes it so impactful?
Well, first, the raw emotion. It's visceral. Adam and Eve aren't just sad. They are utterly devastated, ashamed, physically forced out by this grim-looking angel.
And the nudity. That was bold too, wasn't it?
Very bold. It draws on the newly rediscovered classical ideals of the human form, but used here to show vulnerability, not heroism. Adam is so ashamed he covers his entire face. You can feel his internal collapse. Eve is crying out, shielding her body. It's pure psychological realism.
And this realism influenced later artists massively. You mentioned Michelangelo earlier.
Hugely. Michelangelo absolutely studied these figures. You can see echoes of Masaccio's Adam and Eve in the power, the anatomy, and the intense emotion of Michelangelo's figures.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
In the Sistine Chapel, decades later, Masaccio showed how the nude figure could convey profound human drama.
And there's that interesting detail about the restoration.
Right. In the 1980s, when the frescoes were cleaned, they removed fig leaves that had been painted over Adam and Eve's bodies much later, probably in the 17th or 18th century, due to changing ideas about modesty.
So we see Masaccio's raw original vision now.
Exactly. The restoration brought back that direct, classical-inspired emotional power.
Okay. Moving from raw emotion to technical brilliance, the tribute money. This is often seen as the centerpiece.
It really is a masterclass. It depicts the story from the gospel, where Jesus tells Peter to find a coin in a fish's mouth to pay the temple tax.
And the figures here feel different, more monumental.
Yes. Jesus and the apostles are depicted almost like classical philosophers or senators. They have immense dignity and gravitas. But the real genius, beyond the figures, is the handling of space and light.
How so?
Masaccio sets the scene in a believable landscape, with architecture receding according to linear perspective. But the truly mind-blowing part is the light. As we mentioned, the light source within the painting matches the direction of the actual light coming from the chapel window on the altar wall.
Wait, really? So the shadows in the painting fall as if lit by the real window?
Exactly. All the shadows cast by Jesus, the apostles, the buildings, they all fall consistently away from the real window. It's an incredible stroke of verisimilitude, of naturalism.
It completely breaks down the barrier between the viewer space and the painted space. It's like they're standing there with the apostles.
That's the effect. It creates this unified, measurable, illuminated world that includes the viewer. Plus, the narrative itself unfolds across the space. You see the tax collector demanding the money, Jesus instructing Peter, and Peter finding the coin in the fish's mouth by the lake, all within one coherent scene.
He continues experimenting with space in other scenes too, like the resurrection of the son of Theophilus.
Yes, although that scene was left unfinished by Masaccio and completed much later by Filippino Lippi. But Masaccio laid out the design and painted parts of it.
And what was groundbreaking there?
He really pushed the application of perspective to complex urban settings. He designed this detailed piazza with receding buildings and a paved floor, all constructed according to perspective rules. He's essentially building a mathematically correct stage set on the wall, creating a deep, believable space for the figures to inhabit.
So he's treating the wall like a window into a real, measurable world.
Precisely. Every element is placed logically within that constructed space.
But this incredible burst of creativity in the chapel gets cut short. The work wasn't finished smoothly.
No, it was interrupted. First, Masolino leaves for Hungary in September 1425. He had a commission there.
Okay.
Then Masaccio himself leaves Florence, probably sometime in 1426, heading off for other projects, maybe including the Pisa altarpiece we'll discuss. He left the Brancacci frescoes unfinished.
Why abandon such a major commission? Was it the patron, Felicia Brancacci?
That seems likely. The common theory is that Brancacci ran into financial difficulties, or perhaps political trouble was brewing. Paying for such extensive fresco work was expensive, and if the money dried up, the artists would have to move on.
And the politics got even worse later, didn't they? Affecting the frescoes themselves?
They did. The Brancacci family eventually fell out of favor, becoming enemies of the rising Medici family, and were exiled from Florence.
And this had consequences for the art?
It's believed so, particularly for that resurrection of the son of Theophilus scene. Apparently, it contained portraits of several Brancacci family members. Some scholars think the fresco might have been deliberately damaged or defaced because of this association with political enemies.
Wow, so the portraits that were meant to honor the family became a liability.
Exactly. It shows just how tightly art, patronage, and politics were intertwined in Renaissance Florence. Your portrait in a major public work could be a mark of status, or it could become a target. This might be partly why Filipino Lippi had to repaint sections decades later.
Okay, so Masaccio leaves the Brancacci Chapel unfinished, but he doesn't stop innovating. Around 1427, he creates what many consider his ultimate statement on scientific perspective. The Holy Trinity fresco in the Church of Santa Maria Novella, also in Florence.
Yes, if the Brancacci Chapel showed his mastery of the human figure in realistic light, the Holy Trinity is the absolute pinnacle of applying mathematics, specifically Brunelleschi's linear perspective, to painting.
Describe what we see. What's the illusion here?
The illusion is stunning. Masaccio paints what looks like a deep, classical, barrel-vaulted chapel receding into the flat wall. It's an architectural space rendered purely through paint and geometry. This technique of painting illusionistic architecture is sometimes called quadratura.
And who commissioned this marvel, do we know?
For a long time, the patrons were unknown. There weren't clear contemporary records naming them, but more recent research has connected a tomb structure located right at the foot of the fresco with the Berti family.
The Berti family. Were they major players?
Not like the Brancacci. They seem to have been a more working-class family from that quarter of Florence, but known to be particularly devoted to the Holy Trinity. And importantly, the fresco itself includes portraits of the donors.
Ah, like in the Brancacci Chapel.
Exactly. Kneeling just outside the sacred space, you see the male donor on the left looking towards the Trinity and his wife on the right looking towards St. John. Their presence grounds this very theological architectural vision in the human reality of 15th century Florence.
And this is the work where Brunelleschi's perspective system is just perfectly executed.
Flawlessly. It's considered the earliest surviving example of systematic, single-point linear perspective applied on a monumental scale. This isn't just an artist suggesting depth. This is an artist constructing depth using precise mathematical rules.
What was the method called again?
Costruzione legitimate. Legitimate construction. It's the method Brunelleschi worked out. The idea is to establish a single vanishing point on the horizon line, typically at the viewer's ideal eye level.
Okay.
And then all the lines in the scene that are parallel in reality but receding from the viewer, like the lines of the ceiling coffers or the edges of the floor tiles, if there were any, these lines, called orthogonals, all converge towards that single vanishing point. This convergence creates the illusion of depth and ensures everything scales down proportionally as it gets further away.
It sounds incredibly precise, not exactly clumsy. How did he physically get those lines onto the wet plaster? Did he just eyeball it?
Oh, definitely not. The precision came from the process. First, he would work out the geometry, luckily on paper. Then he'd make a rough drawing, a synopia, on the wall layer beneath the final plaster.
Okay.
Then, after applying the fresh plaster layer, the intonaco, he needed to transfer those precise perspective lines. The evidence suggests he actually hammered a nail or peg into the wall right at the vanishing point.
Physical nail.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Located just below the base of the cross.
Yeah.
Right around where a viewer standing in the church would naturally look. Then he'd attach strings to this nail.
Like spokes on a wheel.
Exactly. And he'd stretch these strings taut across the wet plaster and either snap them like a chalk line or impress them directly into the plaster to create perfectly straight orthogonals radiating from the vanishing point. You can still see the marks today if you look closely.
That is incredible. He's literally pinning the painted world together with geometry. It completely shatters that clumsy nickname when it comes to his work. Maybe the nickname was purely about his social awkwardness or messy clothes.
It almost certainly was, because the execution of the Holy Trinity is the absolute opposite of clumsy. It's rigorous, controlled, intellectual. The illusion it creates is profound. The flat wall just seems to dissolve into this deep coffered chapel space.
But it's not just a technical exercise, is it? There's deep meaning here, too.
Absolutely not. The technical mastery serves a profound theological and human message. The main scene shows God the Father standing behind, presenting the crucified Christ, with the Holy Spirit as a dove flying between them. Flanking the cross are the Virgin Mary, gesturing towards her son, and St. John the Evangelist.
And the donors below them. But then there's that striking element at the very bottom.
Memento mori.
Yes.
Below the main scene, painted to look like it's in a lower tomb niche, lies a skeleton on a sarcophagus.
A stark reminder of death.
And it comes with an inscription directly addressing you, the viewer. It reads, Io fui già quel che voi siete e quel che io sono voi anche sarete.
Which translates to,
I once was what you are now, and what I am, you shall yet be.
Chilling.
It's incredibly direct. It's a memento mori, a reminder of mortality. It forces you to confront your own inevitable death. The skeleton is often interpreted as representing Adam, whose sin brought death into the world.
So the whole composition connects our earthly life and death with the promise of salvation.
Precisely. You have the reminder of human transience and mortality, the skeleton, Adam, us, at the bottom, connected visually and spatially to the eternal divine reality of the Trinity offered above as the path to salvation. The whole thing is sometimes interpreted as a visual representation of the journey from death to life through faith, all contained within this perfectly rational, classical architectural framework. It's a synthesis of science, faith, and human experience that became a benchmark for everything that followed.
It's just astounding how much he packed into those few years. Between the Brancacci Chapel work and the Holy Trinity, he also undertook another major commission, didn't he? The Pisa altarpiece in 1426.
That's right. A large, multi-panel altarpiece, a polyptych, commissioned for a chapel in the Carmelite Church in Pisa. The patron was a Pisan notary named Giuliano di Colino degli Scarsi.
And we know the payment.
We do, interestingly. The contract specified 80 florins.
How much was that?
A lot. It was a substantial amount. The florin was a stable gold currency. 80 florins wasn't a king's ransom, but it was a solid, respectable fee for a major altarpiece by a sought-after artist. Especially significant if, as we suspect, he was leaving the Brancacci Commission partly due to payment issues. This shows he was in demand and could secure good work elsewhere.
But like the Sagra, this altarpiece didn't survive intact.
No, tragically. It suffered the fate of many large polyptychs, dismantled and sold off piece by piece, probably in the 18th century when artistic tastes changed.
How much of it do we have now?
Only about 11 panels out of an estimated 20 or more have been tracked down and identified in various museums around the world. The beautiful central panel, the Madonna and Child, is a highlight, and it's now in the National Gallery in London.
Looking at the surviving panels, what do they tell us about his development right at that moment, 1426, just before the Holy Trinity?
They show him really mastering that sense of sculptural weight and human presence in his figures, perhaps even more so than in the earliest Brancacci scenes. The Madonna in the London panel is incredibly monumental, solid, and deeply human. Her throne, too, is depicted with perspective, but it feels heavy, imposing.
More Donatello influence here.
Very likely. There's strong evidence suggesting Donatello was also working in Pisa around the same time, 1426. It seems probable Masacci was deeply influenced by Donatello's sculptural innovations first, really getting that sense of weighty, three-dimensional form down. Yeah. Then he fully integrated Brunelleschi's more rigorous mathematical perspective system across the entire composition, which culminates in the Holy Trinity the following year.
So Pisa is maybe peak Donatello influence, and Holy Trinity is peak Brunelleschi integration.
That's a plausible way to see the rapid progression, yes.
And then after this incredible, intense burst of activity, the Brancacci frescoes, the Pisa altarpiece, the Holy Trinity, it all just stops. Masaccio dies. End of 1428.
Just like that. He was in Rome at the time. He was only 26, maybe just turned 27.
Do we know how he died?
Not for sure. The historical records are silent on the exact cause. The most dramatic story, the one Vasari repeats, is that he was poisoned.
Poisoned? By who?
Vasari suggests a jealous rival painter. You know, someone threatened by his revolutionary talent.
Is that likely? Or just gossip?
It's probably just legend. A dramatic way to explain the shocking, sudden loss of such a young genius. It might have been illness, an accident, we simply don't know. But the poisoning story stuck.
Whatever the cause, his surviving output is incredibly small, isn't it? Considering his impact.
Shockingly small. Only 4 frescoes are universally accepted as being entirely or substantially by his hand. The Trinity and his major contributions to the Brancacci Chapel, expulsion, tribute money, parts of others. Then you have the scattered panels from the Pisa altarpiece and the San Giovanni triptych. A few other panel paintings, like a St. Jerome and St. John the Baptist, also now in London, are attributed to him, sometimes debated. But that's basically it.
Just a handful of works, yet they changed everything.
Utterly. His immediate legacy was profound. He fundamentally shifted Italian painting away from the idealized decorative linearity of the late Gothic style towards a style grounded in observation, perspective, human anatomy, and psychological realism. He essentially laid the visual groundwork for the entire High Renaissance.
And we have Vasari's word for how influential he was, even generations later. That quote about the Brancacci Chapel being a school.
Yes, Vasari is emphatic, he says, and it's worth repeating. All the most celebrated sculptors and painters from his time until now have studied his works in the Brancacci Chapel, and he lists them. as Leonardo da Vinci, Perugino, the Divine Michelangelo, Raffaello da Urbino, Andrea del Sarto, and many more.
Leonardo, Michelangelo, Raphael, they all went to school at the feet of Masaccio's frescoes.
They had to. To understand perspective, how to model form with light, how to depict convincing human figures and emotions, Masaccio had set the standard. Clumsy Tom became the essential teacher for generations of geniuses.
The ultimate irony, indeed, considering the mathematical precision he mastered. Hashtag tag tag outro. So let's recap this deep dive. Masaccio. The catalyst for scientific perspective in painting. The master of realistic light and shadow through chiaroscuro. The inventor of the truly solid, volumetric, psychologically real figure in Renaissance art.
And he did it all before he was 27, in maybe 6 years of independent work. It's just staggering.
A foundational contribution by any measure.
Which brings us back to that thought from Vasari, and it's a powerful one to leave our listeners with. Vasari lamented Masaccio's early death, saying he would have brought forth much greater fruit if death had not carried him off so suddenly.
You can't help but wonder.
Exactly. If you think about the sheer scale of the revolution, he started applying mathematics to vision, merging humanism with observation, what might have come next if he'd had another decade, or lived as long as Michelangelo.
What artistic or even scientific leaps might he have made?
Would he have pushed atmospheric perspective further? Maybe experimented with even more dynamic compositions? Could he have applied his understanding of form and space to sculpture or architecture even? I can only speculate. But considering the immense foundation he laid in just those few years, it's one of art history's great what-ifs, isn't it? What more could Clumsy Tom have achieved?
A truly compelling question to ponder. His surviving works are few, but their impact was immense. We absolutely encourage you, if you can, to see the Brancacci Chapel frescoes and the Holy Trinity in Florence or the Pisa panels in London and elsewhere. They really do reward close looking. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.